in a tit-for-tat move, Tehran blacklists dozens of British and EU-related individuals and entities for backing terrorism and inciting violence in Iran. According to a UN report, more than 11,000 children have been killed or maimed during nearly 8 years of the Saudi-led war on Yemen. President Joe Biden stresses Washington's strong support for Kiev in the war with Russia. He says the U.S. is focusing on boosting Ukraine's air defenses. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Iran slapping sanctions on dozens of EU and British individuals and entities over their support for what the foreign ministry is calling acts of terrorism and rioting in the Islamic Republic. The ministry says that the measures target 17 individuals and entities in Britain and 15 in the European Union. They were blacklisted for backing terrorist groups and inciting terrorism, violence, and hatred in Iran. The ministry says that those acts fueled the recent riots and violations of the rights of the Iranian people. The sanctions include visa bans and asset freezes. Tehran had earlier imposed similar restrictions on other British and European individuals and entities. The EU and UK have imposed several rounds of sanctions on Iran for alleged crackdown on protesters during the recent incidents. Tehran rejects the allegations and says it has been dealing with rioters. Iran once again strongly condemns the decision by European satellite operator Eutelsat to take Iranian news channel Press TV off the air. The foreign ministry spokesman says this is politically motivated and aimed at preventing the voice of the Iranian people from being heard. Nazar Kanani says that Europeans preach others on freedom of expression and the free flow of information, but they move to block off Press TV despite its compliance with international rules. The official also slammed European countries for hosting TV channels that foment violence and terrorism in Iran. Eutelsat has warned Press TV that it will take the broadcaster off the air. Press TV has strongly condemned the decision. The United Nations says that more than 11,000 children have been killed or maimed in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. UN Children's Agency UNICEF saying that hundreds of thousands of kids also remain at risk of death from starvation or preventable diseases such as cholera and measles. Around 2.2 million Yemeni children are acutely malnourished, a quarter of them aged under five. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a war on Yemen in 2015. Hundreds of thousands of people have died ever since, either as a result of war or indirectly through unsafe drinking water, disease outbreaks, hunger, and other reasons. A UN brokered truce this year lasted 6 months until October, but warring sides have failed to agree on an extension. International relations professor Jamal Hakim says that the West just does not care about the toll that the war in Yemen has taken on children.
This is not the first time they do that, actually. If we take the precedence of Iraq, when Iraq was put under sanctions for nearly 12 years and 500,000 children were affected and died of these harsh measures, when the former Secretary of State of the United States, Madeleine Albright, was asked about that, she said that it was a mere collateral damage. So this has been the case in many other situations. Whenever the war actually was in favor of the Western geopolitical agenda, i.e. the United States, UK, France, and other Western powers. So the case in Yemen is not new and unique because we've been witnessing the West doing the same in Iraq, doing the same in Afghanistan, elsewhere in Africa, for example, without being liable to any penalty, to any punishment, or to any criticism.
Israeli atrocities against Palestinians still going on. The regime forces have killed one more teenager in the occupied West Bank. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, a 16-year-old girl was shot dead during an Israeli raid in the eastern neighborhood of the city of Jenin. The raid also left three injuries. Jenin has been a focal point of Israeli violence against Palestinians in recent months. The regime has also intensified crackdown on people across the occupied territories. So far this year, the Israeli military attacks have taken the lives of around 220 Palestinians in the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. When it comes to Israeli settlements, there is no gray area. International law spells it out very clearly. They're illegal. Yet Israel has continued with this illegal move, and companies have been complicit in it, from construction firms to businesses. The United Nations is attempting to update its database of companies that are engaged in Israel on this front, but the U.S. is objecting to this move.
The United States is pressing the UN not to update a blacklist of companies doing business in illegal Israeli settlements. The U.S. has said things like it opposes any work to update it, or our view is that this database only serves to reinforce an anti-Israel bias that too often finds traction in UN venues. It also said that this database poses a genuine threat to companies doing business or considering business operations in the region. Yet the U.S. statements lack any concern about how these settlements are illegal in the first place. The U.N. Human Rights Office published a list back in the year 2020. It was a database of more than 100 companies that it said are doing business in Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. The database took more than 3 years to complete. It was hailed by campaign groups as a significant step forward in making sure that big business respected international law. The overwhelming majority of the 112 firms named on the database were Israeli, including many of the country's main banks. But the list also included a number of well-known international companies, including, among others, Motorola Solutions, General Mills, TripAdvisor, and Airbnb of the U.S., Apodo, and J.C. Bamford of the United Kingdom, and Alstom of France. Israel's largest banks provide services that help support, maintain, and expand unlawful settlements by financing their construction in the occupied West Bank, including partnering with developers to build structures on land unlawfully seized from Palestinians. A 41-page report called Bankrolling Abuse, Israeli Banks in West Bank Settlements, detailed the scope of banking activities in settlements and the violations to which these activities contributed. Israel's seven largest banks provided services to the settlements. But funding for illegal settlements took the form of donations, like from the U.S. In the year 2015, an investigation into private U.S. funding of settlements revealed a network of tax-exempt charities that funneled hundreds of millions of dollars to Jewish communities in the West Bank. The money was transferred from New York, Miami, Texas, ending up in Hebron or the Old City of Jerusalem, and all came from organizations for which donations were tax-deductible in the U.S.
Now, it's not only Israeli settlements that are illegal. Businesses operating on occupied land and generating revenues can also be deemed illegal. And that's one of the messages of the BDS movement that stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. And this has angered Israel, which does not want companies to stop operating in the occupied territories.
Israel is already suffering from the BDS movements, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, which works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and to pressure Israel to comply with international law. One of the issues that BDS exposes are products that are made in settlements and sold outside of Israel. BDS says the purchase of these products contributes to the Israeli regime and companies operating in occupied Palestinian lands. Israel has built more than 100 settlements in territories it captured from Jordan during a war in 1967. Under international law, the settlements in both the West Bank and Al-Quds, which are home to more than 600,000 people, are considered illegal, although Israel and the U.S. dispute such a characterization. They contribute to a discriminatory regime in which Israeli authorities restrict and stunt Palestinian economic development while subsidizing and supporting Israeli settlements built on land unlawfully seized from Palestinians. International humanitarian law forbids an occupying power from using land except for military purposes for the benefit of the local population living under occupation. Even though the U.S. opposes illegal settlements, its actions by all means support Israel and falls way short of taking any action to stop it. and now with an extreme far-right administration that the incoming Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is forming, settlement building may move at an accelerated pace.
For me, the results of the last elections from last week is no less than a revolution in the national sense and in my personal life, because I've been yearning for a moment when the powers that are for the great Israel and for Jewish values, that these political powers will be in government.
The new Israeli administration, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu and National Security Minister Ben-Gvir, have agreed to legalize settlements. They announced that they will move ahead and amend what's called the disengagement law in order to enable settlers to settle in the northern occupied West Bank. It would legalize dozens of illegal West Bank outposts, something known as Young Settlements. All of this spells bad news for Palestinians who are fighting for their land.
All right, now moving on to Afghanistan. A loud blast followed by gunfire has reportedly rocked the main commercial area in the capital, Kabul. Local media and witnesses saying that a blast took place near a guest house that's popular with Chinese business visitors. No claim of responsibility yet. The attack is the hallmark of the Daesh terrorist group, which has been behind scores of bomb blasts and attacks in recent months. There have been a significant number of Chinese business people visiting Afghanistan since the Taliban's takeover of the country last year. Beijing has not officially recognized the current government of Afghanistan, but it's maintaining a full diplomatic mission there. All right, for more on that from Kabul, we're bringing it our correspondent, Rahmatullah Baghban, to see what else we know on this. Okay, Mr. Baghban, tell us more about this latest blast. It bears the hallmark of Daesh. We're waiting to see who's claiming responsibility and what the damage and casualties are like.
Well, thank you for having me. As you said, today afternoon, unknown gunmen attacked a Chinese hostel or guest house in central Shahrinau area in the capital, Kabul. Mm-hmm. The attackers first opened fire on the security guards of the hotel, then they entered the hotel. And as eyewitnesses say, bomb explosions also occurred in the area. The Taliban spokesman in a tweet has said that the clearing operation in the area has ended. The attackers are gunned down. As Zabihullah Mujahid says, three armed gunmen are killed so far, and the clearing operation is ended. Zabihullah Mujahid, the Taliban spokesman, further added that no foreign guests were harmed as a result of the crossfires, but he said that two foreign guests were wounded after they threw themselves out of the building during the attack or crossfire. People said that they saw wounded people around the guest house. And yet the roads towards the Chinese building is closed, and the Taliban forces have a heavy presence in the area. China's Xinhua News has reported that the Chinese embassy in Kabul is monitoring the situation, and the Chinese diplomats are safe so far. And they added that, it is, or the Xinhua News agency confirmed that a Chinese guest house was attacked this afternoon in Kabul. As you said, this guest house was a major home for foreign travelers and Chinese traders in Kabul. As you also mentioned, Shahrinau is a crowded area, also business or commercial downtown, where foreign offices, banks, and hotels are located in. Yesterday, Chinese ambassador in Kabul, Wang Yu, met with Taliban deputy foreign minister Abbas Sanigzai and asked him to improve the security situation at the Chinese embassy in Kabul, because they were concerned about the situation in Afghanistan, in Kabul, mm-hmm. especially, and of course about their embassy. Then in response, the Taliban deputy FM vowed them that securing or improving security at diplomatic missions in Kabul are their priority, and they urge to safeguard or to maintain security for their diplomats and for their mission in Kabul. As you said, Afghanistan have been facing waves of terror attacks, bombings, and armed attacks. And in the recent one, Pakistan mission in Kabul came under a Daesh terrorist attack, in which one Pakistani embassy guard was injured. And the Taliban said that they also have arrested one in connection to that attack on Kabul, on a Pakistani mission in Kabul.
Thank you very much for that. Keep an eye on the story as it's developed. We'll get an update later on if we can. That was Ramatullah Bachman, our correspondent in Kabul. Now, U.S. President Joe Biden has pledged strong support for Ukraine and its war with Russia, with a focus on boosting the country's air defenses.
Goodbye.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
9 out of 10 children in the Gaza Strip suffer some form of conflict-related trauma because of the Zionist regime's violence and attacks against the tiny enclave. Experts say children with autism, who are often highly sensitive to external stimuli, are particularly susceptible to the enduring impacts of war and conflict, which could potentially make diagnosis difficult. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote, when Auni Abu Hatab was a toddler, he preferred to play alone. His mother, Nujud, 28, noticed that his movements were jittery and excessive and that he was unable to make eye contact. She grew concerned and took him to several doctors and hospitals in Gaza. At first, I thought that he could not hear, Nujud said, adding, I went to doctors and they confirmed that there was no problem with hearing. Others said that the problem was psychological. Auni, now 8, has since been diagnosed with autism. Nujud said, we discovered this after years of effort. The National Institute of Mental Health defines autism spectrum disorder as a neurological and developmental disorder that affects how people interact with others, communicate, learn, and behave. Maura Atla, a special education specialist at the Society for the Care of Handicapped in Gaza, which was founded in 1975 and offers services to children with autism, said that children with autism often face misdiagnosis. Many doctors, she said, interpret cases of shock and delay in the use of personal skills in children as disability. Furthermore, children in Gaza already suffer from high instances of trauma as a result of Israeli regime violence, and children with autism, who are often highly sensitive to external stimuli, are particularly susceptible to the enduring impacts of war and conflict, which could potentially make diagnosis difficult. Before Auni's diagnosis, Nujud left doctor's offices feeling confused and frustrated. And while it was a relief for Nujud to understand more about her son's condition, life is not necessarily easier for their family post-diagnosis. At the family's home in Gaza's beach refugee camp, Auni prefers to be near his mother. He likes to draw, but he doesn't like loud noises and the dark. Nujud said his brothers are young and they cannot bear his constant screaming and his nervousness. He hits everything on the ground. His movement is very fast and we cannot control him. Nujud has discovered that the resources for parents of autistic children in Gaza are extremely limited. She said, there are no institutions to take care of him, no hospitals, not even specialists who provide sessions for free. The Abu Hatab family struggles financially as many do in Gaza due to the Zionist regime's 15-year blockade. Auni's father works as a laborer and they share their home with three of his sisters. Recently, though, Nujud heard about Gaza's Society for the Care of the Handicapped and let them know Auni was in need of services. He was then enrolled in the society's Shams School, where he attends classes headed by specialists who understand developmental differences in individuals with autism. Nujud is hopeful that the school will be a good place for him, but like other parents in Gaza, she understands that until the family's financial circumstances improve, providing resources to their autistic child will be a struggle. Wafa Atale, 26, first understood that her daughter, Rawan, was different when she turned 2 years old. We started to notice that she was not responding to her name and that she avoided eye contact, she said, adding, at first, I thought that she only needed time. Just like Auni's mother, Najud, Wafa took Rawan to many doctors, all of whom did not offer a hopeful prognosis. Rawan, now 6, was eventually diagnosed with autism. Wafa said, I wish we knew earlier that she was autistic. Maybe her condition would have been better. The family lives in Al Zaytun neighborhood south of Gaza City and lives off of Rawan's father's income as a baker. They pay $117 a month for Rawan to attend classes at Basmat Amal in Gaza, though they are unsure if they can continue to pay that long term. Basmat Amal, like Shams School, provides classes and developmental support tailored to individuals with autism. Wafa is grateful to be able to afford the classes, but she acknowledges that the consequences of not having professional support to help with Rawan's development is a daunting prospect. Rawan's behavior can be trying for Wafa, as Rawan often screams loudly and finds it difficult to be still for long. Rawan's mother says, sometimes I lose control over her and I end up crying. I always say that if there was no Israeli blockade and if our financial situation were good, I would travel with her to receive better treatment and deal with experts who could provide me with the best techniques to deal with her. Ahmad Al-Nawati, 22, also attends the Shams School. He said, I enjoy being a student at Shams School. My teacher is lovely and caring. I got to know new friends there. Ahmad's developmental age is 8 years old, and he is progressing along a third-grade curriculum, learning math, and strengthening his reading skills. His diagnosis of autism came later in life, said his mother, Naima, 55. When he was born, there were no services offered to children with autism, she said. How would I know? In that time, there was not enough knowledge about it. Naima said Ahmad's speech was delayed and that he found it hard to socialize with others. She said, I was totally unaware of what was happening to him. I clung to the hope that he would get better with time. Dr. Hamouda Al-Dohar, the head of Nabil Child Care Center in Gaza, which provides services for children with autism, said, I believe that we are in dire need of conducting awareness sessions for all community members, parents, youths, and mothers in Gaza. We need to involve everyone, especially parents, in treatment plans. He believes that greater awareness of autism in Gaza would also help reduce the stigma that some parents say is a problem. Yet certainly, one of the biggest stresses on autistic individuals is the Zionist regime's repeated wars on the Gaza Strip. Naima said that during the Zionist regime's wars on Gaza, Ahmad had found it hard to cope. He said, I hate the loud sounds by Israel, and I can't stand the dark at all. The wars perpetrated by the Zionist regime have worsened his condition, according to Naima. He gets panic attacks, trembles, and screams nonstop when he hears explosions nearby, she said. He experienced depression for a long time. Now, when he hears loud music from wedding parties or any loud sound, even the sound of a car door opening, he gets close to me and holds my hand tightly. I hug him to reassure him that we are fine. Meanwhile, Tasnim News Agency noted, Hamas reminded the world of its responsibilities to criminalize the Israeli regime violations against Palestinians and hold the occupying regime accountable for its crimes. The Palestinian Resistance Movement has recently made the remark in a statement while marking the Human Rights Day on December 10th, which was adopted by the United Nations in 1948. The resistance movement said the world is marking this day as the Zionist regime continues to escalate its terror and systematic violations against Palestinians, including deliberate killings, land theft, siege, and racial discrimination and segregation. It went on to say that the day provides a good opportunity to shed light on the scale and gravity of the unabated Israeli regime crimes against Palestinians. It is also a suitable opportunity to remind the whole world of its responsibilities to take actual action to criminalize the Israeli regime occupation violations and colonial settlers' terrorism, work on putting an end to them, and prosecute their perpetrators as war criminals at international courts, Hamas added. The movement further stressed that Israeli regime crimes constitute a flagrant violation of the principles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and international law, reaffirming its commitment to the legitimate Palestinian rights.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we are focusing on the first and second sermons where Imam Ali alayhi salam discusses about these issues. He talks about the reasons why prophets came and what the prophets did to solve the problems of the community. And we say that the actual problem that was the core issue that the prophets and messengers came for was the spiritual problem, the vacuum that people had in their hearts, the misconceptions that they had in their minds, that the prophets came to alleviate them and, to reignite that spirit of free thinking and the spirit of freedom, true freedom, in the spiritual sense, where people are not confined by material aims and objectives, but have a deeper, understanding about life. And that is what the messengers came for. And if that is solved, then the social, political, and economic issues become naturally solved. And of course, Islam has come with a very beautiful system in politics, in economics, in all of these things that can guide the material dimension very well and create progress in the communities and societies. And we saw that the Islamic Revolution of Iran is one example of how the actual true problems of the people were addressed, the spiritual needs were addressed by the founders of this revolution, and the people realize that this is what we are looking for and this is what we need to create that true change. You
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, coming back to our discussion, we want to look at an example of a prophetic movement in our times to see that, yes, truly, the prophets, they actually came to bring about the right type of change in the community, that the long-lasting change, that type of change that will really solve the community's problems. And we see that that example today in our times is the Islamic Revolution. We are not shy to say that the Islamic Revolution is a prophetic movement. We are not embarrassed to mention that it is a divine movement, because we and the Islamic Revolution is proud to say that it is a system based on the teachings of God. It is not shy of that. It proudly holds the Book of God, and it says that we are basing our life on this particular system. It is not ashamed of being pointed at and being said that you are fundamentalists and that you are people who are, you know, going back to the 1400 years ago system. No, they're not shy of that, because they know and they've realized that the actual needs of the communities will be not solved by something that the mind makes up, or several minds of human beings that are mortal and that can be mistaken. It is not something that will be solved by that, but something that will be solved by a divine power and force. So you know, we should leave all of these discussions and realize that, no, Iran, as a government, the Islamic Revolution, is proud of these things. So, you know, they should not argue with us that, you know, you have come with the Quran and you are going back. We say, yeah, we are proud of that. You know, we are happy. We're actually saying that we have got firm roots that go back in history. And those roots are alive till today. And they are progressing. They are becoming strong. They are becoming more and more firm. They are being watered by the power of intellect of the scholars and the generations of Muslims that are day in, day out, working hard and struggling to maintain their faith and to strengthen their hearts in the direction of truth. So that is one thing that has to be clear in our minds. Another thing that I would like to say is that when we've realized this, that the actual problem that the Islamic Revolution was working on is the spiritual problems, then we see that when Imam Khomeini comes and he announces that revolution, he clearly says that it is a revolution that is going to be guided by God, and it is going to be watered by the teachings of Ahlul Bayt, alayhimu salam. This is something great. This is something unique that the world had never ever faced before, of course, except in the times of the prophets. But now, after all these years, this system has come back, and it is strong and it is firm with strong roots.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, coming back to our discussion. So we see now, when we look at Iran as an example, we see that Iran, it had, from ages had, you know, the system of Shahanshahi, where there were kings, brutal dictators, that were not allowing people to think and progress, which a very, very clear example of class system. People were living under these brutal dictators and regimes for long. Here and there, a few revolutions happened, but they were not effective, because those revolutions were just trying to, you know, alleviate some petty material issues. And those things would not be the actual reason for a strong, fundamental, and deep revolution. But when Imam Khomeini comes and presents his idea to the people, tells them about Islam and how Islam has been disregarded, tells them about the spiritual needs that people require, tells them about the value of human being that is there in servitude and worship, talks about the spiritual connection that a human being can have with God, and then says how these issues will actually create material progress for the community, and that Islam also focuses on that. People woke up. People say we will fight. 99% of the community, of the whole Islam, the whole public, they voted for an Islamic government. That means that the people realized that the answer does not lie in some material, some issues, but it is lying in the deep felt, deep-rooted spiritual matters that can only be solved by the teachings of Quran and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And when that occurred is when we see that a prophetic movement happened, which is going to remain, which is going to be strong as long as those values are upheld. So it's not just something that will die down so easily. And if the people continue in the path of the truth, in the path of what the prophets and the messengers alayhi salam wanted, then definitely this ship will reach the safe shores of felicity. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight. Police in Paris arrested at least 74 football fans as violence erupted in the French capital after Saturday's quarterfinal matches between France and England and Morocco and Portugal. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered the story and tells us more. Football fans clashed violently with police officers in Paris following Saturday's quarterfinal matches between France and England and Morocco and Portugal. Around 20,000 people took to the streets of Paris after the final whistle blew in France's 2-1 victory over England in Qatar. Although the mood was originally celebratory, clashes between fans and police officers soon turned violent, with officers spraying tear gas into the crowd and arresting at least 74 people, according to a report by Le Parisien. Video shared on social media appears to show French police kicking and beating several fans who were lying on the ground amid the chaos. Thousands of supporters had filled the famous Parisian Avenue, Champs-Élysées, soon after a match between Morocco and Portugal, chanting, waving flags and honking their horns amid large police deployment. More fans joined them after France's win against England. According to a Reuters news agency, people smashed shop windows and fights took place between the fans and the police. Photographs from central Paris appeared to show several fires, as well as police with riot shields facing off against protesters with fireworks and flares. Local media also reported that some projectiles were thrown at police officers by angry fans. Items being hurled included large pieces of wood and stones. Police officers responded by using tear gas against some young fans, reportedly outside the famous shopping Champs-Élysées Dior Street. According to local media, the atmosphere on the streets changed around midnight, with one of families celebrating earlier in the evening to groups of young men who began smashing shop windows and clashing with police. Several stores on the Champs-Élysées had already been boarded up in anticipation of the night's festivities. Several motorcycles were pictured on fire, and flames could also be seen on Avenue de Friedland, close to Champs-Élysées. As clashes turned increasingly heated, videos on social media appeared to show some fans being kicked and hit with batons by police officers. Shattering glass could also be heard in the background of the videos. On Friday, 9th of December, French authorities announced that more than 1,200 police officers would be mobilized in order to deal with any possible disorder in the streets. Some streets in the surrounding area were flooded with police vehicles. Paris had initially erupted with joy as crowds celebrated a famous French World Cup victory against England. Renditions of the national anthem, La Marseillaise, and Allez le Bleu could be heard across the freezing cold streets of the French capital. England's quest for World Cup glory had been brought to a heartbreaking conclusion after a vital penalty kick was missed by Harry Kane. This saw France eke out a breathless 2-1 victory in Qatar. The teams went into halftime tied at 1-1, but Les Bleus managed to claw their way in front when their all-time top scorer, Olivier Giroud, scrambled in front of Harry Maguire and guided an excellent ball from Antoine Griezmann in at the near post. For a moment, it looked as though France's lead was going to be short-lived when substitute Mason Mount was bundled to the floor in the box and was awarded a penalty. But star striker Harry Kane, having scored an assured spot kick just minutes earlier, saw his second effort soar over the crossbar, sending the three Lions crashing out of the World Cup at the quarterfinal stage. Gareth Southgate's men were clearly devastated at the final whistle, the players listing helplessly around the pitch in utter dejection while the French contingent erupted into celebrations. Gareth Southgate made a beeline for his captain Harry Kane, who looked as though he could scarcely believe the result. England's captain had sunk to his knees at the final whistle and his teammates requested television cameras to turn their focus elsewhere. Jude Bellingham, meanwhile, collapsed in the turf in tears. Gareth Southgate showed true sportsmanship in defeat by congratulating France captain Hugo Lloris, while the remainder of his players saluted and applauded the fans while holding back tears. The Euroweekly News website has also covered the same story and gives us more detail. At least 74 people have been arrested in Paris, France, following violent clashes with football fans following the World Cup matches featuring France and Morocco. Violence flared in the French capital, Paris, late on Saturday, 10th of December. According to Le Parisien, at least 74 people were arrested in the vicinity of the city's famous Champs-Élysées Boulevard. The nationalities of those detained were not specified by the publication. Around 20,000 people had gathered there in the festive atmosphere following France's victory over England in the 2022 Qatar World Cup earlier in the night. Local reports said that the detained troublemakers had been throwing projectiles and fireworks at police officers. At midnight, the police were still actively dealing with a large crowd of football fans. A special security operation aimed at fighting crime to ensure the safety of goods and people in Paris in the inner suburbs and in the public transport system had been announced in advance on Friday, 9th of December. As a result, 1,220 police officers and gendarmes were deployed from 4 p.m. in the French capital. A specific operation was also put in place on the Avenue des Champs-Élysées in order to prevent any disturbance to public order likely to be generated by supporters and to fight against all the phenomena of delinquency, specified the Prefecture of Paris Police. To avoid traffic congestion on the axis leading to the Arc de Triomphe, several access gates to Paris via the Ring Road, Porte de la Mouette, Porte Maillot, Porte de Tains and Porte Dauphin were closed from 6:30 p.m. Patrols had also been deployed in train stations in Paris. Another night of violence is anticipated by Paris police when France play Morocco next Wednesday, 14th of December, with a place in the World Cup final at stake.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith which has been narrated from Imam Al-Qadhim alayhi salam. This hadith is about sins and predestination. You know, predestination is one of those very tricky topics. It has been alluded to in the Quran and the Hadith, but generally, our religious leaders, the Aima alayhim salam, they have a kind of advised their followers not to dwell into this topic deeply. Imam Al-Qadhim alayhi salam said, sins cannot be other than one of three cases. Either they originate from Allah, which they do not. In this case, it would not be proper for the Lord to punish his servant for what he has not committed. So in this hadith, the Imam kind of presents an argument, a kind of like a, what we call a, you know, a... an argument or a demonstration in which he wants to prove that the actions of man, they're not predestined. He says that, you know, these sins that a person commits, actions in general, but in sins in particular, right, there are three alternatives, you know, possible alternatives regarding them. Either they originate from God, solely from God. This is incorrect because in this case, it would be injustice for God to punish his servants for actions that he has, forced them to do. Right? In this case, you know, the servants would simply be recipients of the actions. They wouldn't be agents of the actions. The agent would be God. In continuation, the Imam says, or that they originate from him and the servant together, which they do not. And in this case, it would not be proper.